historical novels. Have I mentioned the reference to Solon in one of Renault's historical novels? I may have, because it's a really neat passage. This is a novel which in some sense is about tyranny. Because in the Greek context, tyranny is not a negative term. A tyrant is basically a popular dictator. Hugo Chavez comes pretty close to being a Greek tyrant, although he was actually elected, but in the sense of somebody who, on the whole, as I think Renault says, the tyrants have a tendency to be, if anything, more men of the left than of the right, in the sense that they tend to be sort of for the masses against the aristocracy kind of thing. But she has, in one of her novels, the protagonist is a professional poet. And she has pictures of three different tyrannies. These are all Greek. And one of them, the tyrant, is a competent but not particularly benevolent person. And he's doing a good job of running his island, because he has to do a good job in order that he can be rich. But he's also living high on the hog and, you know, in some sense rather corrupt and so forth. But when he ends up dying, it's a catastrophe, because things fall apart. The second one, the tyrant, is the tyrant of Athens, well before the period we're looking at, before the democracy, really. And he's competent and benevolent. And as Renault portrays it, he was the younger lover of Solon, who gave them the laws. So it's just after that. And as he himself says, when Solon made the laws, everyone liked them except for one thing. Everybody wanted one thing changed in his favor. So Solon left Athens, because he said, if I'm not here, they can't make me change it. And then one guesses Solon's dead by now, he never says, but then the current tyrant says, they kept his laws. They keep them still. I see to that. Who could have given them laws they would like less well? And you've got this picture of this man who, by his memory of his dead lover, is a sense kept honest and competent. So it's a neat portrayal. But then he dies, and his sons succeed. And for a little while, it sort of runs on momentum, and then it slides down, because they aren't the men of the month. Anyway, it's called The Praise Singer, if you want to. But Renault, in general, I think, is very good for portrayals of class clowns. All right, let me, as usual, let me stop talking for a moment, because I want, as usual, to start by seeing whether you have comments and things you want to discuss. As I may have said, I've tried to shift this year in both my seminars to less lecturing, on the grounds you've already got what I've written on the subject, and therefore have most of what I'd say in a lecture. So did you have points that you wanted to raise? Yeah.
Well, can we talk about a little bit about the economy of Athens?
Sure.
Trying to make some sense of why they came up with their system. I mean, I know a little bit about it. But
that is, Athens, I would say the two major things in the economy are agriculture, like everybody else, and the silver mines. And the silver mines belonged to the state, were worked with slave labor, and I gather produced quite a large revenue. That, in fact, I may have the figures here. I found figures somewhere on total, if not, they're up on the web page, on various total expenditures. I think they're not here. But, yeah. No, I didn't look at my notes. But if you look again at the notes that are... I think it's actually in my notes on the book, my sort of outline of the book. If people don't want to read the whole book but want to get more than was assigned, I do have a fairly detailed outline of it.
Do you know where the silver mines are today?
I don't. My guess is that it's known. You'd think since they were there for a long time, it would have to be known, but I really don't know. But my memory was that the income of Athens was not radically less than the income of the Persian Empire, which is pretty impressive and makes it look like a little bit less of a David and Goliath conflict than we usually think of it as being. We know agriculture and silver, and pretty clearly there's a lot of trade going on as well. And I'm not sure if there's any substantial, I mean, I'm sure there's local manufacturing, but I don't know if that's a serious source of income for the city, so to speak. So what other things do you know about the economy? Beyond that.
Trade, mostly.
Yeah. There are a number of things that sort of struck me about the whole Athenian system, looking at it. That, to begin with, they're historically relatively unusual in having no king or equivalent. They've eliminated that very early on. They did at one time have a king. If you think about the Theseus legends, at that point there's a king. And then they elect by lot. And then the question is sort of, what are the attractions, disadvantages of that? And if you think about it, you could argue that our version of democracy is less democratic, in that you could end up with de facto kings and aristocrats, even if not de jure. That after all, if you look at our history, you could have one really able politician, I'm thinking of FDR, who can stay in more or less till he dies, because A, his position is one where he gets lots of visibility. He's good at what he's doing, which is pleasing enough of the population to get reelected. He's got large resources because he's running the government, so he can, you know, benefit his friends and hurt his enemies. And you can see that there's a real potential. And I think I'm pretty sure you could find examples of modern societies which are democratic in form and which have honest elections, and in which the same person is president for more or less a lifetime. I don't know enough about the details of all of the countries, but I suspect you could find such examples. So you could argue that in that respect, the Athenian system is really more democratic, that it avoids democracy turning into de facto monarchy. And of course, in American history, we've got quite a lot of examples of dynasties. That we had two Adams as presidents very early on. We had two Roosevelts as presidents. I think that was uncle, nephew, if I remember correctly, not father, son. We've had two Bushes, and that was father, son. We may have a third. All right. One of the possible outcomes of the current mess in the Republican Party would be that they give up on everybody and nominate Jeb Bush. He's one of the two people who gets mentioned occasionally as, you know, a possible person if they decide to bring in an outsider. Yep.
Isn't the Bush family related to the Roosevelt family?
I wouldn't be surprised, but I do not know.
I also think they're distant cousins of the Queen of England.
Could be. Of course, everybody is a descendant of Charlemagne, right?
You? Of course, the fact that Daddy Bush's wife is a direct descendant of Buchanan.
I don't know.
She's a direct descendant of
my president.
As well.
Yep. Yep. If you go far enough, then well, the links are far enough apart, though. If you think about, you know, doubling each generation, you get an awful lot of people. Are you aware, by the way, of the argument for population collapse? It's a very simple argument. See, look, everybody has two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, 16. So it's obvious that the population of the world has to have been funneling down forever. Doubled, right? Go back every generation. Anyway, I'll let you think about that one. Each person has two parents. That's twice as many people as him. Four grandparents, eight great-grandparents. So just going up the triangle, as it were, it's clear that the population in ancient times must have been much, much larger than it is now.
Gaudi in Roosevelt's case is that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was less close to Teddy than his wife. His wife is actually a closer relative to Roosevelt.
That's interesting.
He was like a second cousin.
Yeah.
His wife is actually a first cousin.
All right, yeah, that's what we read. But anyway, so as I say, the Republican thing, you could end up with three, and we've had two already. We may end up with two Clintons. We don't know, but I would have guessed that Hillary is a plausible candidate for the Democratic nomination after Obama either loses the election or serves another term. Husband, wife. Oh, yes. Yeah, no, you're right. India is a...
Indira Gandhi was Nehru's daughter, and her second son became the Prime Minister of India, and he was later assassinated after he was out of office. And now that son's son
wife.
Is now.
But wasn't there at some point one of the dynasty's wives who had no genetic?
Gandhi, she's the wife of the murdered former.
Right, that's right. So she was also.
Now the political leader of Congress.
Yeah.
No. Not elected.
But you're right, India is a good example, because pretty clearly India has had a real democracy. My friend Gordon Tullock used to say the working definition of a real democracy is that the ruling party has lost two elections. That one election could just be a mistake. But I'm pretty sure that in the case of India, Congress has dominated it, but has, I think, lost at least two elections. So it's a real democracy, and yet it's a democracy in which one family has held the top position for, what, two-thirds of the time, something like that. So it seems to me you could, if you were an Athenian trying to explain what was wrong with our system, which would be sort of a fun to sort of dialogue to write, you know, do it, somehow you'd imagine that we pick an intelligent Athenian with a time machine or something, and we explain to him how, you know, Athens is called a democracy. What kind of democracy is that? You elect by lot, and he's had a chance to study our history, and he starts explaining how much more democratic it is than our system. But in other cases, if you think about Romney at the moment, you've had father and son who were governors of two different states, both of whom were reasonably serious presidential candidates, though one of them didn't make it and the other very likely won't. We don't know yet. If you think about the Kennedys, you're talking about one president, three senators, three senators and an attorney general, and one other fairly serious presidential candidate. Though Teddy never got the nomination, I think, fortunately. That's another question. So in any case, if you think about how what seems to us the democratic system works, it's fine to say on paper that everybody's equal, but everybody isn't equal. It's hard to imagine a society in which it was literally the case that everyone was equal, and some people are more talented, and some people are more famous, and they're richer, and some people have a political machine built up by their father or uncle or somebody which is now loyal to them. If you think about Chicago, for example, where Daley was succeeded by Daley. Probably haven't told you my Chicago, New York story. That the story is that back when Lindsay, who was sort of, I think, a liberal Republican, as I remember, was running New York, somebody from New York goes to visit Chicago. And he comes back to New York, and his friends meet him at the airport. They want to know, what is it like? And his answer is, I have seen the past, and it works. Because Lindsay's didn't work very well, and, you know, Daley's was an old-fashioned city machine, and certainly corrupt, but it functioned tolerably well for running the city. This, for those who don't recognize it, there's a famous story about somebody, I think, in the 20s who comes back from the Soviet Union, an American leftist of some sort, and is asked by friends, you know, what is it? And said, I have seen the future and it works. Wrong, as it turned out, but that's what the story is playing off of. Anyway, so it was interesting. And not only do they not have a king, they don't really have an aristocracy, as far as you can tell. That my guess, I mean, certainly there are people who are richer than others. There's a good deal of inequality of wealth on the available evidence. And they, in fact, have it classified into first, second, and third property classes according to where in the army you go. So that basically, and I think even the third, if I've got it correct, I'm not sure if that's the bottom, because the third class were hoplites. That is, they were armored infantry. And they were supposed to have an income of 600 to 900 drachma, so I think that's probably above the ordinary working man, though not hugely above. And their armor and weapons were supposed to cost something like 300 to 500, so about half a year's income that you were obliged to spend on equipping yourself, but only once. You could use your father's armor and so forth for, assume it lasted. But then the top class had an annual income of about 1,500 drachma, so something like two or three times as much as the third class, which was still maybe twice what an ordinary working man was. So substantial inequality. How much, we don't know. Anyway, it's not an egalitarian society, but it's not clear there's anything hereditary beyond possibly inheriting wealth. And you will notice that their inheritance system is equal division among the legitimate sons. And that's going to tend to reduce the ability for wealth to be conveyed generation to generation, because presumably a wealthy and successful man probably has more than one surviving son, and that's dividing up the wealth. So that you can contrast it to the British system, where England had a rule of primogeniture, that the eldest son has the advantage in inheritance, not that nothing goes to anybody else, but that the land has to go to the eldest son, and presumably when that developed, the land was the most important form of wealth for the upper classes. So if you think about how different, I mean, in a sense, it's not immediately obvious, but if you think about something as, in some sense, abstract as inheritance rules, over the long term, they might have significant effects on the structure of society. Yeah?
Oddly enough, in some countries in Europe today, specifically in thinking of Germany, the laws mandate who you have to leave a sizable percentage of your assets to upon death.
That would never happen in America, would it?
No. It's not
in America. Except in the state of Louisiana, where it is the case.
But in Germany,
no, but in Louisiana, you can't in Louisiana, or at least you couldn't. I assume you still can't. Louisiana is the one state that I hope you all know, which is not under a system inherited from British common law, due to the frogs having got there first. Spanish got there first, actually, but then the French did. And the result is that it's a system which traces its ancestry back to, I think, is it Code Napoleon, I guess? And one of the rules, I'm not sure if it's still true, but it certainly was true, and I think it's still true, was that there was some restriction on who you had to leave your money to, so that it was a system where I think you could, I mean, I don't think it was all of it, but I think that sons and daughters had some particular claim to some share of your wealth. So that's sort of interesting. But you could, in a way, contrast that, we'll be getting to the Chinese in another few weeks, and there it looks as though the extended family is sort of a permanent hierarchy, and as though that political system probably puts some weight on that, probably makes use of the extended family as one way of controlling people, whereas the Athenian one, you have two sons, and the normal pattern is they split the family property, each becomes the head of his own household, and so you're going to have a significant limit to the degree to which you're going to end up with an oligarchy. And of course, the Athenians, the Spartans, after winning, set up an oligarchy, but it doesn't last for very long. So then, one of the questions that I was in, let me stop for a moment. Did you people have more points you wanted to raise? We got off into one discussion, and then I started talking, which is always dangerous. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. HLA Hart actually is the guy who kind of pioneered legal positivism.
Huh?
He has this idea that the transition between a pre-modern and a modern legal system is the establishment of what he calls secondary rules. And a modern system is one that's marked by not only substantive laws, which are primary rules, but also secondary rules, and there's three of those. Rules of recognition. So those are rules that tell you how to recognize what the law is. Rules of change. Those are rules that tell you how the laws change, and rules of adjudication, which tell you how the laws are judged. And reading through a little bit more of this, it really looks like the Athenians were one of the first people to move, using Hart's system, into a modern legal system, because they had rules of recognition, and that they were one of the first people to write down their laws instead of only.
I thought there was this fellow in Mesopotamia who had a written law code quite a long time earlier.
Sure. Not the first group, but one of the first groups. And certainly they were, their written law was important.
Do we know that the other Athenian cities didn't have written laws? I don't know. Either Athenians or other Greek cities.
Says something about that in the book.
All right, I don't remember. Continue, yeah.
And then they also had rules of rules of change. So I was impressed by how the ecclesia would get together and vote on changing law, as opposed to one person at the head of the society, which just kind of.
Why wouldn't that count as a rule of change too? How about whatever the king says is law, as long as the king publicly announces it? Is that a rule of change from Hart's standpoint?
No.
It isn't.
No. Anyway, given that Hart is important in the legal philosophy, I thought it was notable to see the Athenians fit what he said quite well.
If we think about other systems we've looked at, Iceland, I think, meets all your requirements. It's, of course, a good deal later than Athens. Although some of us, I guess one might think of it as somehow more primitive, and that there's sort of less of a government than an earlier stage, maybe, in some sense. The gypsies, it sounded from at least some of the stuff, I think some of the stuff you read, or some of the stuff I read, as though at least in the modern context, one of the things you can call a Chris Romani for is essentially to change details of the law, although it's mostly for actual conflicts. So they seem to have some mechanisms for changing, and they have a mechanism for adjudication.
The gypsies didn't have a rule of recognition, so they didn't write their laws down.
That's correct. The Somali don't have a written code, seem to have mechanisms for settling things, don't really have a formal mechanism for changing law, as far as I can tell. That is, it sounds as though it's more a matter of, you know, it's changed when judges reach a different decision and nobody objects, kind of thing. I'm just thinking of other of who else we've looked at who might be interesting from that standpoint. The Islamic system, that's interesting, because the Islamic system has procedures for trial and such. But it's not at all clear to me that Sharia meets the other two requirements, does it? Because in Sharia, it isn't like there's a written book of statutes. It's rather you can read the treatises of learned legal scholars who will tell you what they think the law is. And as far as one can tell, at least in principle, it's changing only. Changes really are more analogous to changes in interpretation than they are to legislation.
Right. I also wouldn't call those changes principled changes. I find them more kind of haphazard changes.
And Jewish law is interesting because if you think about the communal authorities during the diaspora, they're beginning to look more like Hart's system because they did, as far as I know, make explicit rules. And I don't know if you would count earlier the Sanhedrin as a legislature or not. It is making rules, but the rules somehow seem to be made or treated as if they were discovered rather than made, is the impression. And you do have procedures for settling disputes. And I guess you have written law in the sense that you've got things like the Mishnah, like Maimonides. On the other hand, they're authoritative only because people believe them. It's not like they've been handed down by a legislature. And in the case of Mishnah, it's an ambiguous law code because it gives arguments different things. So that's an interesting question. It might be fun if you sort of an exercise to try to apply Hart standards to all the systems we look at and see which ones fit. Now, I don't know enough about him. I don't know how much he really knew about the history of law because...
In terms of legal philosophers, Hart...
He's very famous, clearly.
Right. And maybe the most famous until he's like Dworkin, which is obviously modern.
Yes. But on the other hand, it's not uncommon for somebody to be smart and very expert in one field and to overestimate his expertise in another, so that I wouldn't know whether he knew the anthropological literature, let's say, to see what, quote, primitive societies were really like. It wouldn't be astonishing if somebody at his time either did or didn't know about Saga period Iceland. Because there had certainly been 19th century British scholarship on it, and I guess German scholarship on it, I think, also. But on the other hand, it's a little bit exotic, and I just don't know enough about him. But
I was also interested in something that I noted. Apparently, you could plead like additional laws or laws that weren't really written down.
Well, that's the interesting thing they're arguing about. As far as if I remember from the book, it sounded as though some people thought you could, and some thought you couldn't. Isn't that right? Because I thought the author of this book's summary opinion was that you probably couldn't charge somebody of something that wasn't a law, but there's the possibility of going, I think, to the ecclesia directly. Because you couldn't do it to a magistrate because you wouldn't know what magistrate to do it to without a law.
He simply comes out and says, a further complication was that a speaker in court would sometimes invoke an unwritten law a rule or principle which, it could be maintained, was generally accepted by the community, or was ordained by the gods.
But in order to have gotten to the court, he's got to have charged under some existing law, because there's the law who says basically what magistrate and what court he goes under. But I thought, I'd have to go back and look, but I thought that there was some question as to whether you could go directly to the assembly and charge somebody with something where there was no written law.
What I thought was interesting was the parallel between, at first it seemed a little bit nuts to me, like, you have an exception that could eat the entire set of rules.
Yeah.
But then I thought about it, and we kind of thought the same thing. We have the common law, which functions alongside of our statutory law.
That's right. That the American Law Institute is our equivalent of the Islamic legal scholars. Right? The ALI is a private organization with no official status at all that writes the law. How does it do it? It gives persuasive interpretations of what the common law is, which state legislatures sometimes adopt into their legislation, or which courts at various levels often accept.
But not only that, in our own legal systems, you can plead things that just aren't in the statute explicitly. They're just principles of common law or common law actions.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No, I think that's one of the multiple things that I find entertaining about this sort of stuff we're doing is how much of what seems exotic really shows up in some form or other in our legal system. So that it seems to me that if you think about feud systems, there have got to be a lot of de facto feud systems going on in modern society. And they aren't done in the form of taking an axe to somebody, but they're done in the form of, if you do things that harm me, I'll do things that harm you, and you know that, and you're therefore sort of careful, and that might mean in the academic world, you know, will I support the guy who got his PhD under you for a position, or argue against him, and it might mean, if you think in the political world, there's been all of this questioning as to whether Ron Paul and Romney do or don't have a secret alliance, and whether or not they do, you could certainly see that in the political world, there's a real potential for saying, you attacked me and made me look bad, therefore I'll attack you. Or even farther down, you opposed my protege who wanted the nomination for Congress or for governor or something. Therefore, I'm going to get you. Or alternatively, you know, the other way, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch my back. So, the traditional definition of an honest politician stays bought. Well, but that's a commitment strategy. Right? That links into things like, if I say, if you kill my kin, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to revenge you, do you believe me? It's to what extent, having made a promise, can I somehow psychologically bind myself to keep it? And you can see there are a lot of contexts where that's the one thing you want to know about a politician. Right? You've got things to do for him. You can donate money to his campaign. You can, if you're a prominent figure, you can, you know, write an op-ed supporting him, and you'd like to know whether or not he'll keep his word to pay you back by supporting the policies you want or giving your friends jobs or whatever it is you're doing.
Sure, that makes sense, because you don't really care why he holds a particular position. You just care that he holds it consistently.
Do what you want. That's right. Yeah. So anyway, I'm sure there are lots of other examples, but it just seems to me that sort of human beings haven't changed a great deal over recent millennia. And that therefore you tend to get the same logical structures showing up, even if the formal structure is different. Anyway, let's. So, other people wanted to make? Yes.
I was wondering about the deterioration. I know that Athens is conquered, and I'm not really sure how much Macedonia disassembles this legal system where it is
five. Well, it gets conquered first by Sparta.
Oh, right.
Right, that's the early one. And then it gets defeated eventually by Macedonia. And I'm pretty sure that the Macedonians maintain the form of the Athenian system. I think what's going on is rather that they expect the Athenian assembly to do the things they want, more or less, since it's risky not to, rather than that they actually, I don't think they ever put in a Macedonian ruler of Athens. It's interesting, because Renault's portrayal of all of this stuff, which for all I know is right, is that Philip is a great admirer of Athens. That from his standpoint, what he wants to be is not the conqueror of Greece, the leader of Greece. He wants to be the sort of the figure who will unite the Greeks against the Persians. What?
Which is in fact what happened to his son. I mean, Alexander is leading an army into Persia that consists of contingents from all the major Greek city states, and they're there as allies, not as subjects.
Yeah, no, that's right. And
so anyways, after Macedon is defeated or breaks apart, Athens becomes essentially a secondary city filled with colleges and debating societies, and people go to Athens to train with the academies, and the surviving schools of Aristotle and Plato are still there or in the area. And then eventually Rome takes it over, and it just becomes a source of Greek slaves heading to Rome with their expertise in math and philosophy and whatnot, and they end up tutoring the Romans.
And when the Romans take it over, do they formally replace the governmental structure or not? Is the assembly still meeting?
Process, but yes, eventually it's entirely replaced. Eventually it becomes just another element of the province of thing. But initially it's not. Initially they're allowed to maintain some level of political autonomy for their internal. That's a standard Roman
behavior. Other points, other things that struck people that interested them? Yes?
I just wanted to understand one of his idioms. He talks about laws that are made by like assemblies of people, like big crowds of people. So you have a judge, but the judge really just listens to everyone who's standing around.
Yep.
And if you use it as an example, Achilles' shield, do you understand what that
Achilles
is?
Achilles' shield has, as described by Homer, has scenes on it. It's got I think he goes into it somewhere in there. So it's a shield, which is, you know, a work of art. And it's showing a sequence of things happening, including, if I remember correctly, what looks like a court dispute of some sort. And I don't remember. I think Homer describes what's going on the shield, if I remember correctly. So I'm pretty sure that somewhere in the book because I think the only reason I know about it is I think somewhere in the book. I mean, I did read the whole book once long ago, and somewhere in the book, I think,
yeah. Yeah, I don't know if there's any sort of documentation about this, but. So you could only bring a case for, you know, if there was a law, obviously a statute that you were challenging. But at the same time, they have no, they could plead anything, essentially. Well, you know, for example, in your chapter, you say that, you know, they could bring their children in front of the jury to try to convince the jury of their
to give them mercy, basically.
But it sounds almost like since they're amateurs who are prosecuting their case, it must have been just sort of bizarre arguments that were brought in front of the jury.
Maybe. And so we do have surviving orations, so you can look at them. And certainly they feel demagogic. But they feel intelligently demagogic. I mean, they're, you know, doing a pretty good job of making their side look good and the other side look bad. They've got very much the feeling that you get in a lot of modern political argument of course we're entirely right and they're entirely wrong. How could anybody believe the opposite kind of thing? There's only both sides are claiming that. But I'm not sure that isn't true to some extent of modern pleadings as well.
Do they have sort of a legal library to go to? These are all pro se litigants, essentially.
That's right.
Have no knowledge except maybe previous cases.
That is presumably, if I understand it correctly, I think the laws at some point were inscribed somewhere so you could go look at them on stone. I'm not sure when that happened. It's not true for the whole period. And I guess they must have been written down somewhere. Then I suppose you would go consult them somehow. But that was just the text of the law. And beyond that, my guess is that all you could do is to find somebody who, you know, had been paying a lot of attention to the cases. But no, it looks to me like a system where essentially where demagoguery is going to pay. It's a system where you've got a big jury. The jury probably, you know, they're hearing this one case for a few hours, and if you can do a good job of making it sound like the other guy's a villain, then you win the case. Only in it sounds more like a modern debate. That it's in the form of the well, there seem to be two different forms. One of them is the prosecution gets to talk for a certain length of time. Then the defense gets to talk for a certain length of time. Then the prosecution gets a rebuttal, a shorter statement, and then the defense gets another shorter statement. And I think for some kinds of cases, there's only one round of that rather than the two that I've described. And that seems to have been the framework of it. Yeah, as far as one can tell. Yeah, I don't want to live there. I mean, it's, you know, fascinating to watch.
Is it clear why you couldn't hire someone? Obviously, for the public cases, there were prosecutors for hire, but for private, for some reason...
For public cases, there aren't prosecutors for hire. For all cases, there are authors of orations for hire.
Okay.
That is, if I understand the system correctly, you either gave a speech yourself or you got somebody who was a better speech writer than you are to write a speech, and probably you memorized it, though it's possible you read it. It would probably look more impressive if you memorized it. And I think the implication here is not so much that it was illegal to have a lawyer as you'd lose the case if you had a lawyer. That basically, from the Athenian standpoint, the fact you weren't willing to stand up for yourself was a very strong count against you. In the Icelandic case, I am reasonably sure that it was actually illegal to pace. It was perfectly normal to go to somebody who knew a lot about the law and get him to give you advice. And there are various people in the sagas, including Njal, who's the person Njal saga is named after, who are sort of thought of as being so expert in the law that it was said that no case was really settled unless they had a hand in it. Because I got it wrong otherwise. But it was illegal to pay somebody for that service. Now, what that really means, you don't know, because if you think about the nature of that society, if you're an honest politician, the way you pay somebody is you don't hand him money at the time, you just make it clear that you now owe him a debt, and if there's ever a favor I can do you, and there are an awful lot of opportunities for favors, you know, you invite him to feast in your hall during the winter or something, you think of things of that sort. That is, after all, a gift economy in which it's quite normal to have what look like really exchanges in the form of I give you a gift and then you generously give me a gift. And, you know, I don't know if I quoted from Habermal, one of my favorite verses from Habermal, which is Habermal, the Elder Edda is a bunch of Norse poetry from about the 9th century or maybe earlier than that. And Habermal is a bunch of verses of good advice by Odin. And quite a lot of them are good. I mean, it's fun stuff. But one of them is, no man is so wealthy that he objects to receiving a gift in exchange for his gift. Then another one I like is, shun not the mead, but drink in measure. Speak to the point or be still. And short and straight is the road to a friend, though he... crooked and dark is the road to a foe, though he on the high road dwells. But short and straight is the road to a friend, though he lives far away. And lots of other stuff. I mean, it's quite a lot of fun. Yeah.
If I might address your point, Athens, up until the Heraclean time, was an intensely oral society. Nothing was written down, or very little was written down. And Socrates himself is famously, one of the dialogues, complains about the fact that we now live in this modern debased age where people literally write stuff down, as opposed to the good old days that he grew up in, when everything was memorized. And he says, this habit of writing stuff down is literally destroying thought. This is Socrates from the dialogue. So the Athenians, you can gather from this and from other evidence that we have, that they were quite good at memorizing large chunks of stuff, forms, you know, speeches and whatnot, and it was just sort of, that was the price of being a citizen in Athens. You literally reel off vast amounts of stuff you had stored in your head.
You realize that Socrates' complaint here is just the rehearsal for the complaint about how word processing ruins writing. We've got this easy way where everybody can write and revise easily, and they don't pay any attention to what they write, and therefore you get terrible writing. But, yeah, no, as I may have mentioned, the historical novel, The Preisinger, I mentioned before, one of the minor things that's going on is that the protagonist, who's a professional poet, has his entire repertoire in his head, and he's shocked when he discovers his apprentice has gotten written down texts of poems. And then there's this sort of neat scene where he's talking with the tyrant of Athens, And the tyrant of Athens has a project to rescue Homer, that to get a full written text of the Odyssey and the Iliad. And he's doing it by having a festival every year at which he invites all of the people who sort of make their living reciting chunks of Homer to an audience to come to Athens and recite chunks, and he gets it all written down, and they can all put together and make a final written text. And the protagonist says, well, why do you have to do that? I know all of the Odyssey and the Iliad. And, you know, then the guy doesn't rebut it. He just reads from his text. And there, as he reads, the protagonist recognizes two lines that he didn't know and that are obviously real. And at that point, he becomes reconciled to the project. And if he didn't know it, his master didn't know it. So at some point between Homer and him, somebody dropped two lines there. So I thought that was a really neat bit. And I have some sympathy with it. I mean, I in fact do oral storytelling for many hours in other contexts. But yeah.
There was as you say, there was a class of people who knew the Iliad and the Odyssey, and the cattle through Greece. I know this from one of the other dialogues, and the other dialogues by Plato. Cattle through Greece reciting sections of it as means of settling disputes.
Huh.
And literally what would happen was, this is in the dialogue, they would go to a place and they would say, according to the Iliad, Corinth sent 30 ships against Troy, and Argos only sent 10. And so that means Corinth is a more important city than Argos. And other people would say, yes, but the Iliad also says that such and such a hero defeated this guy of Troy, and he was reputed to be a greater guy than that guy, and that guy was Corinthian, so that means Corinthian. Yeah, anyway, so literally the oral recitation of the Iliad and the Odyssey was used as a type of a law-giving system
law-arguing system, at least. Yeah. In a way, it's also somewhat relevant to this dispute as to whether the Icelandic sagas were composed in the 10th and 11th century or when they were written down in the 13th, because if people have good memories, maybe you could have it. On the other hand, it's a lot easier to remember poetry than prose verbatim, and their sagas are all prose. Shouldn't say all prose. The sagas have poems in them, but that's rather in the context, you know, at this point so-and-so said the following poem. It's not, it isn't, the work itself isn't in verse. And I should say the author of Heimskringla, which is the saga history of the Norwegian kings, has this wonderful discussion at the beginning of sources. How do we find out what happened in the past? And you read it, and your first instinct, if you're not paying attention, is, well, of course, this is a modern historian talking, but it's not. This is written in the 13th century. And he says that the best source of information is skaldic poetry written at the time. Because, A, the skaldic form is a very tight form of poetry, so you can't easily change one word without messing it up, and therefore it will be stable against changes over time. And second, since the poems were originally recited in the presence of people who have been present at the events they're describing, there was a strong constraint to tell the truth. Now, you would, of course, bias the truth, because the poem was typically being done for some king or other important person who you hope would reward you for reciting a poem in his honor. But if the king had lost the battle, it would be mockery to pretend he had won it, so what you had to do instead was describe how heroically he fought against these heavy odds and so forth and so on. So at least Snorri Sturluson, who's the author of this stuff, argues that this makes the skaldic poems the best sources we have for what really happened in the past. But I like it partly just because sort of one of my general views is that we have too much of a prejudice towards thinking that we're smarter than everybody else was in the past, and so it's sort of neat to see that people really did think about what they were doing 800 years ago. And say intelligent things. All right, the question I wanted to raise, to which I don't know what the answers are there interesting implications to having a government of amateurs? And it's not entirely a historical question, because one of the political reforms that people push from time to time in the U.S. and that occasionally gets passed is term limitations. All right, that there is a convincing, I'm not sure if it's right or not, but an argument which says, look, in our present system, a seat in Congress is a lifetime appointment. That if you actually look at the numbers, it is very, very uncommon for an incumbent to get defeated. It happens either if there's been a terrible scandal, or if there's a big political swing so that his party is losing a lot of seats, but most of the time, I don't know what the numbers are, but like maybe 98% of incumbents who choose to run get reelected. Now that overstates it a bit, because if you know you're going to lose, you may not choose to run, but still, it's pretty striking. And so and it's argued at least that this means that the incumbents aren't really representatives of society as a whole. They're professional politicians. They don't know what life is like for the rest of us. Comment which gets made about Romney now for other reasons, but which has certainly sort of been somewhat funny, the degree to which he sort of, it really sounds as though he's sufficiently used to being a very wealthy man that it doesn't entirely occur to him that the rest of the world isn't. And that therefore saying, yes, indeed, we're car people. Why, my wife has two Jaguars and I don't remember what the list was. But I think she did have two of some Cadillacs. Two of some expensive. Right, Jaguar would have been a bad idea because that's... Right, that's right. And so the argument can be made, why don't we go back to something more like a citizen legislature by saying you can only be in for 2 terms. And of course, we did it for the presidency. Right after Roosevelt. Roosevelt was going to be in until he died. He died. And so they passed a constitutional amendment, I think, which made it limited to 2 terms, which had been the custom before then. I mean, sort of an interesting case. The custom was established by George Washington, who refused to run for a third term, followed by everybody until Roosevelt. Roosevelt, I think, had no doubt but that he was the best person in the world to be president of the U.S., and he persuaded enough other people so that he was able to do it. And anyway, incidentally, on the whole question of sort of news and stuff, how believable do you find it that there was a president of the United States who was a cripple and the fact was not public knowledge? All right, Roosevelt had polio. I'm not sure how crippled he was, but he was noticeably crippled. And as far as I can tell, that fact, although I'm sure there were many people who didn't know it, was concealed from public mention through his lifetime. So, sort of. And now, you know, if he had an affair, we'd know about it with pictures. But anyway, and I think he did have an affair, actually, but we found out about it decades later. Yeah?
What is, how do you resolve the question, or what's your opinion of amateur politicians versus...
I really think the arguments are complicated enough so that I don't have a clear opinion on it. That you can see you can see arguments on both sides. You know, on the one hand, that the amateur is an amateur. He doesn't know what he's doing. And furthermore, if you only have one term, then what's going to make you keep your promises? Right? Whereas if you want to be in for... On the other hand, the present system... I mean, I suppose my preference really would be not term limitations, but to find some ways of biasing the system less heavily towards incumbents. Some ways so that incumbents were really running for re-election. So that, for example, the franking privilege, the fact that the incumbent, as I understand it, can have essentially postage-free PR paid for by the taxpayers. And you could think of a variety of other ways. And I don't know, I'm not sure exactly how you would do it, because being an incumbent automatically gives you publicity. I mean, you know, the news is just going to cover you. And given a government, as powerful a government as we have, it automatically gives you a whole lot of important favors to do for people.
Do you think of any ways to test
Yes. Yes. The question is, I think, though I am not sure, that some states do have term limits. I may be wrong, but I think some do. So in principle...
Only at the state legislative level.
Yes. But in principle, you could try to find some measure of how well state legislatures work. And look at that by states and see. So that would be an interesting project. It would be hard. I mean, all of these things are hard. That I once had a project I never got very far, which was an attempt to get an objective measure of whether the net benefit of a dollar of government spending was more or less than a dollar. Because there's a sense in which that's a central issue of political argument, right? On net, if the government taxes another dollar and spends it, are we better or worse off? And I had thought of a way in which, in principle, one could get a measure of that effect using local, not national governments. But that would be very interesting. It would have been a very hard project to do. And good question? No. Anyway, so but if you think about the government of amateurs, what you can do is look at how they handled it. All right? And how much of the Athenian system came out of that. So that, for example... thing, which I don't think we were in your reading, and I don't think they're in my chapter, but I've got it in my notes here, that Every 36 days, there was a vote in the assembly on how the officials were performing. And if the vote went against any official, he was deposed. And I suppose they chose somebody else at random, I guess, to replace him. And presumably there was some sort of a trial, and presumably if he was acquitted, he gets reinstated. And so I guess maybe it was a vote, maybe the assembly is just indicting him, and then there's a trial. And presumably this is likely to happen because somebody complains about him and persuades the assembly. We don't know that. Every 36 days, a group from the Boule, which was a smaller group than the assembly, examined the accounts of the officials. And if there was a problem with them, they could punish it. A private citizen could accuse an official to the Boule, and the Boule could impose a fine of up to 500 drachmas. So, you know, a year's wage, sizable, although only half the fine for accusing somebody and then overwhelmingly losing the case. Furthermore, at the end of each year, there was a procedure for every service, for every official, which involved essentially an investigation of how he had done. He could not leave Attica until it was completed. And it included a financial inspection by inspectors who were themselves chosen by lot, just as everybody was, to go over his accounts. And then you can have a jury trial where anybody can bring an accusation. If he stole or was embezzled or took bribes, the penalty is 10 times the amount stolen. If he merely made mistakes, if he was incompetent, he was supposed to repay the amount lost. So you can see that being an official could be quite risky, especially if you had political enemies who were reasonably persuasive and could show. Yep.
The idea that we can compare our system to theirs, I think there's one big difference is the amount of complexity involved in deciding governmental things.
Yes.
Compared to, where you seem to say, you're saying that they can just choose by lot people who, anybody who's a citizen is going to...
Any adult male citizen 30 or above, I think.
Right. They're guaranteed to have the abilities to understand the accounting.
Oh, nonsense. They're not guaranteed to.
Oh, okay. Well, because that seems like the big problem I would see with trying to oppose something like that nowadays.
Yes.
Even if you were to look at a general citizen pool, someone with the skill set required to be able to effectively hold a governmental position reduces the amount of people who can build that.
Yes, but it's not entirely clear that we do choose for people with the right skill set, or at least that we always do. I'm thinking of my father's stories on Henry Morgenthau, who was Secretary of the Treasury when my father was working in the Treasury during, I think, World War II, and who I gather was a friend and neighbor of FDR. And my father's claim, at least, was that when the Treasury people presented something to Morgenthau, he would say, well, can you restate it in ways that my daughter could understand? That his daughter was, I don't know, 11 or something at the time, and at least my father's view was that he really meant that I could understand. And eventually he says, no, I can't get my daughter anymore, she's 13 or whatever, I don't know, some age well below adulthood. So at least sometime, I mean, some of them, clearly you have some very, very able and talented and competent people who get positions, but you also get people who get a position because it's a reward for supporting the right person. Sort of notoriously, ambassadors are supposed to be largely chosen for reasons irrelevant to their competency to be ambassadors. And so
it also seems like for Athenians, people who count as official citizens or are male and above the age of 30, that would be such a small percentage of actual population.
It's not that small. That is, I don't have the figures here. I did try to get some rough estimates. I would have guessed that maybe a quarter of the population were citizens.
Okay.
So an eighth of the population would be male citizens, and five and 10% would be male citizens over 30. I'm guessing. I did have some numbers at one point, and if people are curious enough, I can try to figure out where I had them in my notes. But so that. We don't really know how many slaves and medics were, but I think the opinion is there were fewer medics than citizens and perhaps as many slaves as citizens. I think those are sort of the very rough impressions that one gets of the system. But in any case, the fact that they have a system where it's taken for granted that you need fairly tight rein mechanisms for checking up on and punishing officials for misconduct. Now, you could argue that professionals are even more likely to engage in misconduct. It's just they're much better at hiding it. And maybe that's part of what's going on. Note that we do, after all, have a modern, a contemporary, a currently existing society that chooses officials the same way. Remember the Amish. The Amish are choosing a lifetime appointment, not just a one-year appointment. But again, you could argue that the appointment is for dealing with problems within a community of a couple of hundred people, all of whom he knows. They're his friends and neighbors and relatives, and therefore it's not unreasonable to suppose that sort of a random person could do it. And of course, the Amish also cheat because God's making the decision for them, and God wouldn't choose the wrong person, right?
So that brings up the idea that it might be a problem of scale, that this
might be.
That might only work if you're talking about a city state.
So therefore, we ought to do it for Santa Clara University, right?
Yeah. Or, I mean, there might be too many people.
Yeah. Well, but of course, if you think about universities, the university is probably the most common example of a worker-managed firm in a modern American system. Right? It's not fully worker-managed, and it varies among universities. But basically, the decision of who to hire as a professor here is basically being made by the existing professors. Formally, it has to be approved by, I assume, the president of the university and maybe, I don't know, the trustees or somebody. And there will occasionally be conflicts. But it would be pretty much unheard of, and I think at least in any good university, for the president to appoint a professor who had not been approved by the vote of the relevant department. So that's really a case where you have people who are amateurs. All right. Now, more and more in the modern universities, a lot of it's being done by professionals too. That one of the things that's changed over the last 50 or 60 years, one of the reasons your schooling is so expensive as it is that the ratio of administrators to teachers has steadily gone up. Maybe a good thing, bad thing, I'm not giving an opinion either way. But if you think of sort of the university as it was 50 years ago, I think it came pretty close to a system where large parts of the administrative work were being done by people whose qualifications were being an expert in history or mathematics or physics, if he was lucky with a secretary who knew what was going on. And this is also, I think, is the British system. That if you think about how the British government works, my understanding is that the person who is in charge of a department is an amateur. He is a member of parliament who is given that job. But his private secretary, who I think passes on from one to another, I think he's not really his private secretary, is the professional. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Yes Minister, which was a television series, was also a book in England, which was sort of satirical and highly critical of the system. But that's a system in which, as I remember, the standard plot is that the minister of whatever he's minister of, who's an MP, is a well-intentioned, not very bright guy. And he somehow discovers something terrible that's going on. And he says, we got to fix this. And his private secretary goes, yeah, absolutely, we've got to fix it, we're going to fix it. And by the time it's over, the private secretary has exactly reversed what he wants to do. He's, you know, kept in power whatever he wanted to get rid of or whatever. Yeah? Hence, yes,
Minister. I think you're saying you're using the word amateur.
Yes.
Like, for example, in the university professor position, right. Choosing other professors, I would think that if you, in that position, yes, they're not administrators, so they're not.
But they have some expertise.
They have expertise in what they're doing.
But it's also the case that the chairman of a university department is a faculty member.
Right.
All right? They're amateur at administrating. That is to say, the chairman in theory is an administrator. Mm-hmm. All right, it's not all he is.
But
and
everyone in a congressional setting, everyone who comes into Congress will say they've served in Congress before as an amateur.
To begin with, I'm really using amateur, and maybe I should be saying novice, because literally an amateur means you're not paid for it, and of course. And I think the Athenian officials are paid, if I remember correctly, although the Amish ministers are not. But my real point was that they're novices in the sense they aren't people who have spent some noticeable chunk of their time doing this kind of activity. Right? And in that sense, a member of parliament hasn't spent his time running a department, right? He spent his time getting elected and making laws and criticizing laws and that sort of stuff. He's a legislator, not an administrator. And yet, in theory, in the British system, he's in charge of administering the Navy, or the equivalent. Right? I mean... He might have, and you might argue that in practice he will have been administering a political machine, he will have been administering a campaign, stuff of that sort. Although I think probably less so in the British than the Americans, my impression. I think the British system, they spend a good deal less on their elections than we do. It's a somewhat lower key system. But in the Athenian system at least, it really was a random system. And I agree that that looks less and less plausible as you go to larger and larger systems. But that also, it's not just the number of people involved. Suppose Ron Paul gets elected, and his successor is Rand Paul, and they get a majority in Congress, in both houses of Congress, and they do everything they like. And 20 years from now, the government is spending 5% of national income instead of, I guess, all governments together about 40%, 35 to 40%, I guess, federal government, 20, 25% maybe. And there's practically no regulation, and Congress no longer meets all year round, meets for 3 months a year in order to consider if any laws have to. If you imagine the same population, but simply a system in which the role of government was enormously shrunk down, then it becomes less implausible that amateurs are the right people to think, After all, we have amateurs doing juries. I suppose that's the clearest. Again, they're paid, not very much, but novices, if you like. So one critical part of our governmental system, we do almost the equivalent of the Athenian system. Not quite as open, because it's not by law, and people get to challenge and such, but it's basically novices running, making very important decisions, life and death decisions, literally. So it's not completely unheard of, but again, it's on a fairly small scale. So if you look at it, in the U.S. in the 19th century, total government spending was about 10% of national income. And of state, local, and federal, the federal was the smallest of the three. So there really has been sort of almost a change of kind rather than scale between a world where the federal government was spending, 2% of national income, so I'd have to look up the numbers, something 3%, something like that, and one where it's spending 25%. And for that matter, a world where most of what people cared about was happening at the state and local level versus most of what was cared at, a large part of people cared about at the federal level. Yep?
I wonder where bureaucracies fit into this sort of...
Yes.
I was thinking about the FDA, where they're largely... nutritionists and biochemists.
They're professionals.
But they're not professional administrators.
They're administrators, I bet, are professional administrators, don't you think?
Oh, okay.
So my guess is that the answer is that in the government bureaucracies, there are people who spent their whole lives essentially running government bureaucracies, or running little bits of government bureaucracies, and then bigger bits and bigger bits. I may be wrong, but that's my suspicion of what's going on. Yeah, that's right. But not uncommonly, the person at the top is a novice, in the sense that the person at the top is a congressman, or an ex-congressman rather, maybe an ex-governor, some politically able person, and now part of that job does involve dealing with human beings. In a sense, he's got some kind of an expertise, but he's presumably got to rely on the level of professionals below him to tell him what to do, which gives you a lot of inertia. I've been reading my parents' autobiography, and one of the things that my father discusses were some attempts he made to persuade the Treasury to change the way in which they auctioned off bonds, to get them to use a Dutch auction rather than... Dutch auction is one where the high bidder pays the bid of the second high bidder. And therefore, the argument for it, it's the way eBay works now, it's the argument for it is that you have an incentive to tell the truth about your value. That in an ordinary auction, what I'm asking is not how much is this item worth to me, but what is the lowest bid that will get it that's below what it's worth to me. With a second price auction, I say, well, look, what I'm going to have to pay isn't my bid, so I can afford to bid the full value to me, and I'll only have to pay the value to the guy who bid second. But his comment was that this was a completely non-political issue. And he was entirely unable to persuade the Treasury to do it, basically because of inertia. because the treasury knew that the way they were doing things now was the way they had to be done. And he gives some other examples of that same pattern in other contexts. And that almost certainly is the professional bureaucrats. And that could be one argument for having the non-professional at the top. There's some small chance that he will see that the way you all take it for granted has to be done is wrong and push through some change. Anyway, I thought that was sort of an interesting bit. It's an interesting book, I should say. It's sort of interesting seeing one's parents' world through their eyes instead of your eyes and the different things that, you know. So let me... Oh, yes, another thing that I thought was sort of neat, which I think also is not what you read, but was neat, not necessarily in a positive sense, but interesting, is that it was apparently a crime to mislead the people. And misleading the people did not have to be intentional. That there is one case where a man says to the assembly, give me 70 ships and I will enrich you. He's proposing a military expedition against someone or other. And they give him 70 ships, and he has the military expedition, fails, is mortally wounded, and is charged with the crime of having misled the people because he said he'd enrich them and he didn't. So that was sort of, again, interesting in the sense of having a sort of binding promise mechanism, as it were, in this system where you can say, how do I prove that what I'm telling you is the truth? I'm taking the risk that if I fail to achieve what I did, I will be punished in some fashion. I think in his case, fine. So I'm not sure if he was dead by then, if they find his estate or if he was dying or whatever from the...
Actually, I think they would have executed him, but he was already on his deathbed at the time.
Uh-huh.
That's what
the book
indicates. Uh-huh.
All right.
A likely punishment.
Yes.
Rather brutal.
Yeah. I didn't remember that. I was going by my notes, so I hadn't reread that passage this time. Yeah. Let's consider another bit which struck me as interesting to us, and that's the whole status of medics. Or should we be imitating it? After all, we've got this huge problem in America, which nobody has a real solution to, though everybody claims to, of illegal aliens. There are millions of people here who almost nobody seriously believes you can get rid of. Many of us don't think you should get rid of them, but even when you should, it's pretty implausible that you can. As far as I can tell, so far, only one candidate has said anything at all in their favor. All right? One of the few good things about Gingrich in this campaign is that he hedges a whole lot, but he at least says, if these are decent, God-fearing, hardworking people who have been living in our community for 20 years, we shouldn't be sending them back to Mexico. All right? What?
Harry didn't give you supported education for children.
That's right. No, I guess you're right. You're right. I was unfair. Perry also said something again, fairly weak, but in that direction. No, one of the few things I liked about President Bush, who I thought was a catastrophe, was that he was at least less hostile to immigration, much less than his party, and probably less than the country as a whole. But maybe we should do. Maybe what we need is the Athenian solution. Maybe we ought to have a category. We do in theory. We've got non-citizen legal residents.
It turns out that in fact the system that Athens has is very similar to the system of just about every other country in the world. No country, or almost no other country, actually grants citizenship simply because you have to be born by accident in the country that you were born in.
But
no one does that except the United States.
Yes, but that's a historical accident. But the question is, to what extent do countries have a sizable recognized status of legal resident, not citizen, not in the process of becoming citizens? Because my impression is that this has really been an issue in Europe with immigrants, especially from places like Turkey, that you've got immigrants from poorer and largely Muslim countries who find working in Europe very attractive. So that Germany, I think, has quite a large Turkish population. And it seems to me it's sort of a running dispute. Is the solution that they are permanently non-citizens, guest workers, medics? Or do we say, well, no, that's just sort of a temporary situation, but of course we assume that either they'll go back home or they'll become citizens. And as far as I know, the U.S. had the Bracero program a long time ago. But even then, I think it was assumed that wasn't long term. I think the assumption there was.
During the Second World War, and it was thought to have going to come to an end after the Second World War ended, and it was finally ended by Kennedy.
But I think the implicit assumption is people who come in for a few years to work. And so the question is, would it be a good thing if we claim to imitate Athenian juries, Athenian democracy, even if we don't imitate it very closely, should we imitate their citizenship system and say, all right, we've really got a two-class system, let's admit it. There are us people who get to vote and them people who don't. Anybody have opinions on that? Good thing, bad thing? Yeah.
Is that not so different than a place, say, like Dubai, where you have you guys are going to be Emiratis, and you people are going to do all the work and get paid this wage, because it's better than living in Bangladesh.
And do they expect the immigrant workers to stay?
I mean, I think they expect that there's going to be a workforce there.
But is the assumption, is the model, a model where somebody comes in, works for a few years, makes enough money to be pretty well off when he goes back home and goes back home and then somebody else comes, or is it the model where you've got generation after generation of these people staying in?
I'm not sure.
Because I wouldn't be surprised if the model is the former, but the reality is sometimes the latter. Yep.
But aside from not voting, what else, what other rights would they be entitled to?
That's an interesting question, because the Athenian one, they can't own land. And that doesn't fit very well with our system, I don't think. See, because after all, foreigners can own land in the U.S. Do.
Medics couldn't marry Athenian citizens.
Right. And again, that's very unlikely to apply here. So, yes. They'd pay tax. There's a proposal I made a long time ago, since people make these arguments about the people coming in. That is, the argument that's made against immigration, which is a perfectly good theoretical argument, I don't think actually fits the facts, is that given our level of welfare system, it pays somebody from a poor country to go here with no intention of working and just live on welfare. And that if we had free immigration, that would happen. And that you can then say the virtue of illegal immigration is because they're illegals, they find it much harder for them to claim welfare, and therefore... I think the evidence suggests it's probably not true, that what probably is happening is, yes, indeed, if assuming we let people come, they could come and live on welfare, but the amount they can get by working what they regard a perfectly reasonable level of work is so much more. You know, why be satisfied with just being twice as well off as you were at home when you could be 10 times as well off? But it's a legitimate theoretical argument. And so the proposal I made 40 years ago is, let's have a rule which is, new immigrants come in. They aren't entitled to any of the benefits. But just to be fair, they also don't owe any of the taxes that pay for those benefits. So that would be a different double. And I then suggested we then have the possibility, of course, of American citizens abandoning their citizenship in order to get this deal. But I think given that we're looking at Athens, which was a functional society, even if you can criticize it for a long time, it had this system. It's worth at least thinking about whether a variant of that system would be the least bad solution. I mean, my view, of course, is the right solution is to let them all become citizens. But then I have highly unpopular views on the general immigration issue.
You don't have to go to Athens to look at it. It happens everywhere.
Well, does it happen everywhere in the sense of people who are expected to remain in this status?
Yeah.
All right. Because I thought that my impression of the German case was that it might actually happen, but the official view was that it wasn't supposed to. The people were supposed to become German citizens, you know.
Only if they learn German, you know, essentially.
But they're supposed to learn German, of course.
So far.
Yeah, as I say, but yeah.
One of the big issues with that in Germany and Holland as well is that they brought people in to work agricultural jobs, which is a certain section of the demographic in Turkey. That's usually a more conservative population. You're not getting people from Istanbul coming to work. So they come, and one of the big problems is that they have problems with assimilation because you're bringing the most conservative people from the society, or not the most, but on that end of the spectrum.
Well,
and seeing how to melt the two. The interesting situation there is now the next generation of Germans, the young kids that are of Turkish descent whose parents came there. And you can see it in a sports context. The German national soccer team was all white, and now the team is Turkish and Bosnian, and you see it slowly happening in other countries too. Italy now has a few black people, and the sport reflects really well the immigration at the lower end of the stratum. Because most professional soccer players come from poorer environments. It's a really good.
But then, are the kids of the Turkish immigrants in Germany growing up speaking German as well as Turkish.
So his issue is the kids of those people now have dual citizenship. And they've grown up in this.
Well, they do. I thought he was claiming that was only in the U.S.
No, I think they were saying that they have eligibility now to represent Turkey as a national team. So now Turkey is just...
Not as a team. Are they German citizens?
They are German citizens, but they have to become Turkish citizens to represent Turkey.
I wonder how they have citizenship. I mean, their parents weren't German citizens. They themselves were born in Germany. Did Germany just decide, okay, you're a German citizen? I mean, how is that...
Yeah, I don't know how they become... I mean, at some point, there's an incentive because these people can make tons of money for Germany.
Yeah.
So, but that's a very special case, though. But what about the 99.9% who aren't athletic stars?
Do you know? Citizenship if your parents were living in Germany legally at the time you were born.
Yeah,
why don't you look it up? We've all got web access because I'm curious. But notice going back to your point about the lowest stratum, that somehow America around 1900 was absorbing Sicilian immigrants who were the same people you're describing, basically. And as far as you know, we don't have a big problem with Italians being uneducated, you know, yahoos nowadays. That is, if you're interested in the American history, I recommend Ethnic America by Tom Sowell, which is quite an interesting book on the immigration into the U.S. And in particular, he includes the comparison of the immigration of blacks from the South into the North as fitting in many ways into the same pattern as the Italian and the Irish and the Jews coming in from Europe.
Well, if you lose the accent after one generation, the corn makes just American. If you're black or Asian, you come in one generation later, like you're a Chinese person that was scrambling in here in 1845, you'll still get treated.
Maybe. There are parts of Chicago where the signs are still in Polish. I mean, I think ethnic identification often lasts a good deal more than a generation, and where there is ethnic prejudice, it doesn't require skin color because there are last names, there are various other markers. And, but anyway, read the thing. It's an interesting book.
So it occurs to me that not only is another...
So are you going to find out for us?
I'll look at the... I actually have your... I don't know why I didn't bring it up, but I have a comparative German
European immigration law file on my computer, and if I have been...
Well, let us know. I'm curious. Because it is a case where you've sort of got a problem that existed in Athens and exists all over the world now, and they've got a solution, and there are other possibilities.
Immigration in Europe is a fascinating...
Yeah, especially given that the existing populations are disappearing.
It's right now it's pretty open to labor. It's going to become a mess. They're saying now that everyone's moving. They're saying, oh, now that everyone might need to go west, that they're going to go west. They're like, but everyone's going to leave your homeland once the squatting life starts improving. There's less incentive for you to leave and go be a foreigner and second class citizen.
Romania is not going to catch up to Germany in my lifetime.
No,
Italy.
Romania is catching up to Italy.
This is true. Anyway, so it occurs to me another legal system to be worth exploring would be Sparta, because we have a fair amount of that Sparta.
Yeah.